Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission? This episode is part of a larger series called Momentum, presented by Monogram Appliances, which aims to celebrate Asian leaders. Elevate your culinary domain with Monogram Luxury Appliances, where sophistication meets performance. Each piece is crafted for those who demand excellence. From precision-engineered ovens and cooktops with sapphire glass, to stunning refrigerator interiors that use aerospace technology, you can experience the art of cooking like never before. Monogram is redefining luxury in the kitchen. Visit monogram.ca and transform your kitchen into a statement of elegance and innovation. Ava.
Hi, Lance.
Hi, I'm so glad that we're talking here today. We've crossed paths so many times. I've eaten at your restaurants and I've had your incredible food, and now I get to have like this chat with you. I'm so excited to be chatting.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, happy new year, by the way.
Happy new year. I'm excited for one more new year to come.
Yeah.
I'm going to celebrate that hard in a month.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm really, really glad that we can have this chat because I've been a fan of yours, and I think you have such a beautiful and important perspective on your craft and what you do. And really, I think your work is reflective and such a testament to the power of food and drink and hospitality and the impact it has beyond the four walls of a restaurant, you know, and what that says about us as a culture, as a community. You know, food is such a powerful gateway to having those discussions, I find.
Absolutely. I think one thing I learned about food is, you know, it doesn't matter if I know you or not. It doesn't matter who we are. It doesn't matter if we don't speak the same language. I think as I bring out a plate of food, that is already immediate connection with someone, you know, without even having to understand each other's past stories, current situation. The fact that anyone can just share a moment and eat something is quite powerful.
Yeah. And also food is always, you know, it's so much more than just at its most fundamental level, like sustenance. It's about connection, and whether that's connection to other people or connection to your roots or connection to another culture and community too, right? And I'm sure you've seen that with your diners and seeing kind of the journeys that they're going through as they're, you know, kind of navigating through your menu or like a tasting menu as well.
It's been really interesting serving just strictly a tasting menu these days because I really, as you said, you know, like Yan is a communal seated restaurant. I love more than anything to watch people connect over a meal at Yan. Mm-hmm. You know, it was my food who brought people together and became friends. And, you know, after 4 months of opening now, I am getting messages from folks that attended my dinner, who sat across from each other, who didn't know each other, and are now going out on food dates. And I think, you know, more than anything, that's what I crave is bonding communities together.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, what do you find is kind of the biggest difference or maybe like the biggest joy that you have in your experience building a tasting menu versus a non-tasting menu at like a restaurant overall?
It's a choice, you know. I respect that, you know, even myself including, that sometimes people want to go to a restaurant and just have two dishes and a conversation. It doesn't have to be that every time you come sitting in a restaurant, it has to be a three-hour curated experience. I think that's the main difference, is whether or not people want to have that experience or just a quick meal with two plates or just being able to choose what they want. Sometimes I like going to a restaurant knowing exactly what I want, being able to just order what I want and nothing more, nothing less. I love being able to give that option to people. But through tasting menu, I have really been able to connect with people. And, you know, even when Yan goes on to become its own restaurant, it will never... The days of Yan Dining Room in the back room of Hongxing is something that will never be replicated. It's so, so special. And all I can do right now is just cherish every moment of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to rewind a little bit and then bring us to that point. But can you just give me, I'm sure it's hard to summarize your entire career, but if you can kind of give me the highlights reel of your journey as a chef, restaurateur, you know, in and out of Toronto as well. What's that been like for you?
Rewarding, I think, would be the right word. I keep thinking back of just this common quote saying, the climb is hard, but the view is great. Mm. I think that really would summarize my career. You know, I think I really belong to the elder millennial line. Mm-hmm. I really belong in that genre, like a truly, truly raised in late 80s, 90s. And I really got to see, I really got to witness still the hard work of the previous generations. I was taught by them. I was raised by them. Yes, I was also surrounded by the toxicity of them. And being able to carry all of that in my youth and be able to have the time to reflect that and learn from the new generation and incorporate that now in, you know, I think we're very lucky. We're the last of our kind to be able to witness the past and be part of the future. Mm-hmm. I think one of my biggest challenges right now is actually working with peer young generations that weren't able to witness that. And I think being the last people to witness that, it's a lot of responsibility on our shoulders. And so if there's anything that I thought I wanted for my career back when I started, nothing of that exists now. You know, nothing that I wanted when I was young entering this career is what I want now. What I want now is more, is beyond food. You know, I think speaking up for the community, talking about, you know, what changes can be implemented and for being part of creating what would be the future is now what my career has all around.
Yeah, I love that. The goalposts have changed
as you completely.
Yeah, evolved as a human being over the years. Yeah. What would you say was like the biggest turning point for you and kind of this new perspective for yourself in your career?
It was the day I realized, oh my God, what I'm in is not a perfect system. I was, you know, like I drank the Kool-Aid for so long and I was so very much, I was enamored by the system that I was part of. And I thought I was part of it up until, it was just one day I was literally standing there and every problem of our industry just like showed up in front of my face. Like the lack of equality pay, you know, the no benefits, you know, and just like really watching everything that I ignored and suddenly came up. That was a changing moment. I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Mm. I was like, oh no, I can't ignore this anymore. And from that very second, my entire career perspective, my career shifted from just putting my head down to making food to what's more. And that, from that day on, every step I made in my career was different.
I really love that. Because I can see that in the work that you do and, you know, whether I'm seeing that through social media or through your menu or just even through, like, you know, secondhand through mutual connections that we mm-hmm. have, is that there is like a ripple effect in the work that you're doing and it goes beyond what's necessarily just on a plate and on the table in front of us too, right?
Well, I'm inspired by the other people doing the same thing, you know, like mm-hmm. like you, Madeline, Evelyn, being able to be, and you know, I gotta say that was something that Toronto really shines at, is the level of loyalty to community is huge. This is something that I did not get to witness in Vancouver, sadly, you know. I know it exists, but I was in a different, you know, time and place is very important. I was a different time mm-hmm. and it was a different place then. Being able to be in Toronto right when COVID was hitting and when all the changes of people's perspective was happening was major for me. Being able to be at Momofuku at that very time presenting Asian food to Toronto was a very specific time and place. Being able to push a Lunar New Year package in the middle of COVID, that was an opportunity. And I think all of these things led to the platform that I was able to be given in Toronto now.
Yeah, yeah. And to your point, because how long have you been in Toronto now?
I moved here in March 2020, 3 days before the city shut down.
Right. Oh my God. That was a wild time.
It was crazy. You know, Momofuku recruited me in November 2019. And then the move was in February, late February. And even at that time, watching all the news, I still didn't anticipate what was going to happen.
Yeah.
I was set to fly to New York 2 days after arriving in Toronto for, you know, for the whole orientation course. And then New York declared a state of emergency. And I was like, okay.
Oh, my gosh. I know, to move to a city like this, which I think, you know, I've been here for about 13 years now.
Wow.
But it's also, I've noticed the identity of the city has changed a lot. And, you know, it's really a city of like a lot of global perspectives, a city mm-hmm. of people from outside the city. But it still feels like a small town in a lot of ways because the communities intersect so much and mm-hmm. it's, you see a lot of the same people. But yeah, to move to the city at that point and then, you know, what it in and of itself is evolving is such an interesting time to that probably shaped a little bit of your perspective there too.
It was. I was very lucky. I mean, we originally took the job because my partner is from Toronto. Mm-hmm. So it made complete sense to take that offer. I was very lucky that she has been preparing me about Toronto for years, you know, the weather, the people, the culture.
What was the number one piece of advice that she gave you? Warning.
People are not soft.
Yeah, okay.
You know, she told me people are not soft. People in Toronto are just a lot more authentic and go-getters. And she's like, you're going to love the pace because I am someone who, I love the pulse of the city. Throughout my career, I've only situated myself in restaurants that are in the city. And so that was the first most exciting thing for me. And, you know, the first 2 days arrived in Toronto, I live downtown as well, and it helps. Just feeling the pulse of the city, and I love it. It starts really early. People are hardworking here, and people hustle, and I love that.
Yeah, well, and also, because your history, you've seen a lot of, you've been and worked in a lot of cities with dense cultures and global perspectives, and so how did your background in those cities and those communities really lend itself to your kind of how you wanted to make an impact here?
I would definitely say, you know, Toronto still has a ways to go, of course, to compare to cities like New York and Hong Kong and LA. But for me, being able to have worked in those cities allowed me to kind of take it to the next level, I guess, in Toronto. Mm-hmm. After seeing what I've seen, after being able to experience what I've experienced in cities like Hong Kong, knowing that there's a lot more to push past what people already think is a maximum, it allows me to take it to the next level with my team, with anyone that I work with.
Yeah, and it's kind of going back to that point about the goalpost moving and changing,
exactly.
Evolving. Exactly.
You see further, you know, the vision changes. And I think my job right now is to not just execute what I see, but also to help my entire team see what I see, so everyone strives to push to the next level.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get.
I'm just gonna put this coffee down.
Yes, yes, yes. Here, we'll do that. Thank you. How is your eye doing? Do you need a book or anything?
Okay? I'm sure when you're editing this video, you'll see a lot of me going like this.
So I want to get a little bit of insight into your brain when you're, you know, thinking about conceptualizing a menu and testing dishes and everything.
Right.
What do you consider to be like a hallmark of your culinary style and perspective?
If you ask my team, they will tell you that I never like to do the same thing over and over again. And I think for me, it is true. I have, up to this day, I still don't have a specific dish that I haven't changed yet. Throughout the years, usually most chefs like to hold on to signature dishes. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in that. I feel like even my most proudest signature dish could still improve. And, you know, whether it's 3 months down the line or 3 years down the line, as long as I feel like there's something that can improve, it will change. So, for example, like a scallop dish that I have been presenting over the years, whether it was in Momofuku or it was in Aveling or even through Vancouver, but it's by now it's like the 91st rendition of it. You know, so for me, it's just never changing. I am a farm-to-table chef. Mm-hmm. That is deep in my core. It started, you know, mainly because I was raised in a farm. It started also because I worked in very, very produce-driven restaurants, and I came from BC. West Coast is a very different culture when it comes to seasonal produce and eating. And so knowing that I'm farm-to-table also helps me chase the seasons, and it helps with my sense of constantly changing.
Yeah, that's true, actually, yeah. Because it's, you know, whatever's in season, you're adapting to what's available and what's kind of bountiful in a given moment in time. And also just not being, I guess, stagnant in terms of what's being put out.
But that's actually a huge, it's a huge impact on us, you know, immigrant chefs, because as a child of an immigrant family, change is the worst thing ever.
Yes.
Especially in pantry, you know, you know, times are hard with our families. And so the fact that we don't change our pantry is what makes us survive. You know, our parents cook the same thing for 20 years. Farmers Market is not a place that we usually shop at. You know, 99 Ranch is where we shop at, because it's the same thing for the same price over 10 years. And so being a farm-to-table chef and trying to cook ethnic cuisine has been a huge challenge. But it's also given me a chance to remind people that it's ridiculous to think that only French or Italian food should be seasonal. You know, our people conceive that Chinese food is not seasonal because we had to survive in this land with very, very little help and support. And so the food, in order for food to assimilate to the society, it had to be consistent. People wanted to come in every week and get their same general Tao chicken. They don't care if there's broccoli or bok choy, they want neon sauce on the meat. When you have a cuisine based on that history, it is so hard to suddenly allow people to be like, oh, so Chinese food can be seasonal, can be colorful, can be vibrant. The price shouldn't be that low because we are shopping at good quality suppliers and market produce stands. And trying to change that narrative right now as a farm-to-table chef is the toughest thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, if I have family visiting town and I want to take them to a new concept that is a higher price menu for something within my own culture, it's a tough sell.
It because, is. It's completely a tough sell.
Yeah, and it's because it's something new. It's a different approach. And you kind of, you know, that generation and parts of our generation too want the classics and the standards and everything and don't necessarily have an appetite always for change and innovation and new perspectives. So that's a really, preach, you know, because I get it.
Yeah, it's the first 2 minutes of my welcome speech to anyone who comes in again. As everyone is seated down and I'm in there addressing the group, I'm like, you know, everyone had to walk through those doors outside Hongxing restaurant. People who walk through those doors and come in to get seated at Yan witness bowls of beef and broccoli going out, bowls of chicken balls going out. I'm like, what's happening out there in the dining room is what got us here. Like, that's how our forefathers brought us here. But what's going to take us there? You know, that's my number one question. Is it, do you think this is going to continue taking us there? I don't think so. People's palates have changed. People's requests for Chinese food have changed. A young Jewish kid is making a Chinese food empire. Like, people are beyond, you know, takeout boxes of Chinese food. Mm-hmm. So even though we, our own community, believe that we shouldn't change and we should keep things the way they are, it's just not working because what gets us here doesn't necessarily get us there.
Yeah.
And so that's why Yan was born in the first place, because it is me and Colin trying to question what's going to take us there.
Yeah.
What is the evolution of Chinese food, Chinese Canadian food?
Yeah, which is a very separate thing sometimes.
100%.
Like that's a distinct cuisine too in and of itself. First, to that note, I really love the notion of your diners going through a journey before they've even been seated at the table, because that is in and of itself a storytelling element and is kind of crafting a story of like past meets future, you know, and before they've even had a taste, you know. So yeah. I think that's such a beautiful thing. My other thing that I've noted from what you just said is, what is your perspective? Well, I think I know what your perspective is, but what are your thoughts on who holds the keys to culture and advancing the culture within our community or outside of our community? Do you think that, what's your perspective on the larger dialogue around who is able to build restaurants, push forward a cuisine, if it's outside of a community and everything?
Everyone should have a chance, you know, like for the longest time, I have been, for forever actually, since I've been able to have extra cash, I go traveling. And then throughout my younger years, I'm always traveling Europe, I'm traveling Japan and all that. It took me until, I think, in my mid-20s that I started being like, why am I not traveling? What is it about China that's scaring me? Mm. It's my own people, it's my own language. And, you know, obviously I did my travels. I was traveling on China for 10 months with a backpack. I went to every single province. And it took me that, all of that, to realize, wow, our community back in North America are so ashamed and so scared about the core of our true culture that they would rather travel to every country in the world before they consider about the motherland China, if it's a motherland to them. You know, as you said so yourself, Canadian Chinese cuisine is a whole different genre. So then Canadian North American folks are a whole different genre to thinking what's you know, patriot, what their patriot concept is, yeah, about being Chinese. You know, they're proud to be Canadian before they're proud to be Chinese. That's a whole different subject to talk about. But because of that, I realized finding people within my peers who have traveled China was really hard. Mm-hmm. And then I started connecting with the Caucasian folks who went out of their way to get a visa in China so that they could enjoy that country. When I was in China, all my friends were not Chinese. I had English teachers from UK. I had yoga instructors from Brazil. Like, it was the expat life. And I was talking to everyone but Chinese folks who are so stoked to be in China. You know, this girl called Amina, she is the Brazilian yoga coach. Like, every morning, she and I, like, would go and find the best dumplings just down the street. And over the years, being an expat in Asia made me realize that it's not about our folks or their folks. It's any folk who just loves our cuisine and our culture. And when I came back to North America, it was very, very sad to find that I wasn't able to connect that with my own peers. You know, when I was able to talk about, you know, what's exciting about Chinese cuisine, you know, this is like mid-2010s at that time, people were like, oh, but I went to France last weekend and this is what I really like. And it was really hard to connect that. And I understand that there are trends, but to me, if I can't even find people within my own community to go back to China, I guess the hope is on the outside. Mm. You know, when Sunny's first opened, when Mimi's first opened, when I reached out to David and we became friends, I am so happy to know that this kid who's not even Chinese loves our culture more than our own peers. And if it takes someone like him to awaken young Chinese cooks to be into their cuisine, that will be it. That will be the answer. You know, I don't care if it's someone in our community or not, so long as they are just trying to spread the good word. Yeah. I tell people that my ultimate dream one day is to walk into any French and Italian restaurant and the pasta station cooks are cooking pasta with a wok. To me, that's the true bridging of communities and gaps that, you know, a lot of times boundaries, regionality separates us. Mm-hmm. If people can see Chinese food techniques as important as French and Japanese cooking techniques, then it'll be incorporated in all types of cuisines and restaurants. You know, there are people now who are taking sashimi culture, you know, it's been going around for a long time in Japan, but it is hot. It is hot and heavy now, and restaurants are using it. That's what I hope to see about Chinese cooking technique, that it gets assimilated into the trends and streamlined. It's not just an exotic thing.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever watch Culinary Class, is it Takedown on Netflix? It was like the 100 cooks against each other.
Yes, I love that show.
excuse me, your note kind of reminds me of the pasta guy, because he is a Korean chef that like specialized in Italian cuisine, but then also kind of merged his perspective on that too. And it was just kind of interesting to, when you're talking about the wok in the Italian kitchens, that's kind of a little bit of what that reminded me of too.
Yeah, to be able to see that cultures can bring the best of themselves to create the best version of that dish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's the dream.
I know that your dishes are always evolving and changing, and you don't have like a per se, like a signature dish, but do you have a dish that you've made in the past or that you've created
that you hold really close to your heart because of like what it meant to you or what it signified at that point in time for you?
I really like my crudo dishes. I like to explore a lot of flavors through crudos because it's, number one, it's always going to be the first few bites of the menu. So it creates a very strong impression. Mm. Throughout the years, I've always had a different rendition of an East meets West crudo. You know, in Vancouver to Toronto, and up till now, I'm still exploring that with a scallop crudo. Right now, this has been my narrative for the past few years. I did it as a tuna, an aveling, and I'm doing it as a scallop, but it is a play on, it's a Sichuan-inspired crudo, where you don't see any form of red on it. Because and the story behind it is that when you think about Sichuanese food in North America, the first thing you think of is spicy. Mm-hmm. Spicy, red hot chili pepper, red oil, red Sichuan peppercorn, aggression, mm-hmm. mouth on fire.
Numbing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. While that is very true about Sichuanese cuisine, it's not the entirety of it. And this goes back to me saying, like, you cannot put sweet and sour pork as the face of Chinese food. You cannot also put chilies, spicy, and numbing as the face of Sichuanese cuisine. When you actually go to Sichuan, the province, 50% of the province serves non-red food. Like, I'm talking not even a drop of red oil. It is aromatic, it's tingly, it's almost like a more demure version of Sichuan food. Mm-hmm. And it's all green. It's heavy on herbs. It's green Sichuan peppercorn. It's green everything. And so I wanted to share that point of view of Sichuan food through crudos. And so right now, like, our scallop crudo is all green, but when you eat it, it's like you're eating Sichuanese food. There's still the aromaticness from the green peppercorns. There's still a form of mala, but then, it, like I said, it's just a much more demure version, and you're also more refreshing and more herbaceous.
Very exciting. and on that note, how do you think that the palette of the diner has evolved over the years or over the span of your career? What are kind of some of the big changes that you've noticed in diners, but also, I guess, like, food culture overall?
First of all, people are much more in the know, which I'm very grateful for. And again, thanks to restaurants being able to push forward Chinese cuisine and trends. You know, for the longest time, people didn't know what chili oil is. And now there's a whole debacle about chili crisps. And that's okay. Like I said, the goal is to see Chinese food being assimilated and streamlined into regular culture. I'm not asking it for it to be specially, like, highlighted. It's just that it could be an everyday conversation. That's something that my ex-boss, David Chang, instilled in me. He once told the company, he's like, the dream is to see kimchi, soy sauce, as part of the everyday American pantry. And it's true, though. When you look at it, up to this day, still in stats, that the highest amount of takeout ordered is Chinese food. Second is pizza, right? So the demand is there, and people are practicing it, but no one's just really understanding or bridging the gap that it has become our everyday. It is not exotic. It is not ethnic. There's no ethnic aisle for this. It is everyday pantry. And so for me, I just want it to be an everyday conversation, you know, and that is what's happening. People are talking about Asian food like it's an everyday conversation, that it is normal. It's no longer a chai tea experience.
Right.
People are actually understanding and going beyond just knowing the food. They're actually making sure that they're appreciating it well.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, that's what I want to see. And that's what I'm excited seeing right now happening. People are coming in. They already know, I know what Sichuan food is. Actually, I had it for the first time last week. And then they want to know more about it.
Like the curiosity.
Yeah.
And the openness.
Yeah, the curiosity, openness. And then because they already know it, it's not scary. They want to know more of it.
What do you hope that diners are walking away from an experience in your dining room?
Open-mindedness.
Yeah.
Because it's a blind tasting menu. Sometimes, like, I come out and I explain each course, but I don't tell you what's everything in the dish. There are still dishes that you don't know what you're exactly eating. You know, I slipped in jellyfish in one of my Brussels sprout salad. And I didn't even talk about it when I was explaining. I just really focus on the fact that this is a dish celebrating Brussels sprouts. And then when guests are eating it, you know, servers are coming to me and they're like, the guest wants to know if this is a jellyfish. I'm like, yep. Yep, it is. And then it's just really exciting to see that up to this day, I still, thank God, knock on wood, I haven't had experience where people are furious, but I'm able to witness people trying things for the first time that they have never tried. And they're walking away saying, okay, that wasn't bad at all. Or like, I actually want more of that. You know, I don't do modifications. So even if you don't like cilantro, you're still getting cilantro, you know? So people are walking away facing some of their fears, and I like that. Mm-hmm. And I want them to know that, you know, our food isn't scary. We're diverse. You know, we use every type of ingredient out there, but it's not scary.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, conversations that I have with my peers and my partner and a lot of my friends is like, especially if you're meeting someone new, and understanding that like their kind of approach to food, and if you find out that someone is like an extremely picky eater by choice, it says so much about them in different ways beyond the you know what they their food preferences, you know their spirit of openness and ability to try new things. And I think to kind of your realm, there's a lot of like fear and anxiety that people can have when it comes to food. But to your point, when people are given the opportunity to discover things that they thought were strange or exotic or scary or whatever preconceptions they have, it opens people's minds up in different ways that go beyond just their food preferences.
Absolutely. It's upbringing, you know, like, as again, I said, children of immigrant families, we don't have a choice. You know, what's put on the table is put on the table. If we don't eat it, we don't eat it all. You know, so growing up, food wasn't something that our parents begged us to try. It was a necessity of survival.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously Chinese food is so tasty. I never really rejected my food growing up. I just, if it's on table, it's yummy. Mom's food is always yummy. But you have to think about how North American folks are raised. You know, kids are... like their parents begging kids to eat right now, even if it's one bite, and it's, and the food that they're choosing for the kids to eat, you know, when you're limited in a specific bubble, when you've only had berries from a box, when you've only had food, meat that doesn't have bone on it, skin on it, you know, when you are only used to a certain type of food culture growing up, then that's what happens when you grow older. You know, you become limited, you become scared. You become picky, you know, and food becomes scary.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for us, it's always like diving into the unknown has become part of our DNA, because our parents are constantly trying ways to make ends meet with different cuts of meat, different proteins, different vegetables. Diversity is actually a lot more profound in ethnic cuisine than your major North American cuisine.
Yeah. I love that. How would you say your heritage has influenced your, I mean, I know that obviously Chinese cuisine is so much a part of your perspective, but, you know, you grew up in so many different places, Hawaii, you were in China, you're like so many different. So how would you say that all those experiences have really influenced what you're doing today and in like in Yan right now?
I find a lot of connections because of that, you know, like growing up having Southeast Asian culture, Hawaiian culture, Chinese culture, all of the parts that my family are from are all heavily colonized places. You know, growing up in Hawaii, there's a huge Portuguese colonization there. And I grew up, like even yesterday, I was explaining to my wife why I like kielbasa so much. She, for years, did not understand. She's like, every time you go to a shop, you will buy kielbasa. Like, why is this meat so important to you? I'm like, because I was born and raised in Hawaii, and I grew up with a lot of Portuguese food. One of them was Portuguese sausages. And that was something I cannot find in Canada, except unless I go to a Portuguese shop. So what I do is I think kielbasa is one of the closest things to it. So there's all these different anecdotes from all these different things growing up that actually has nothing to do with the land that my family's from, but it's actually from the colonization brought to it. You know, like, to me, the dearest part of Chinese food to me is Hong Kong cafe food. That's the last meal I'll have before I die. But when I was trying to explain this cuisine to my wife, she's like, I don't understand. Why is there ketchup in fried rice? I'm like, this is not Chinese food, but it's also part of Chinese food. It's what happened after the British colonized Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So growing, as I'm growing older and finding connections and cooking through all the parts that I'm from, I'm starting to realize that there's actually a lot of similarities because we've all been colonized from very similar cultures.
Yeah, there's more things that we as people have in common than
100%
differences too.
I once connected an entire room through a dessert made from Milo.
And interesting.
Yeah, there was a table of eight who came to talk to me and they're like, oh, we really love this dessert. And the table of eight were all BIPOC except for one guy who was this lady's boyfriend. And he's like, I don't know what Milo is. And everyone looks at him and is like, well, you didn't have to. You had fresh chocolate milk growing up.
Right,
you know,
right.
Milo is very much. And at that moment, there were eight different, like there was seven different types of nationalities on that table. But we all knew Milo.
Right.
We all knew what this canned, non-perishable product is because we all had to survive through it. So that's definitely the beauty of connecting all the cultures now.
Yeah, yeah. You've talked about, you know, in previous interviews and, you know, just in your work in general, that your focus is also on, like, Neo-Chinese cuisine. Can you talk about, and this kind of ladders into or emphasizes what we've already been talking about, but how does that, what is that, and how does that speak to your larger identity as a chef?
Neo-Chinese is still very new in my books. It's mm-hmm. something that is, I am still very much trying to find out what it is. It's like groping in the dark. When I first came upon the word Neo, it started in Paris, and it was Neo-Parisian. At that time, all these little bistros were open up in Paris, and they were all disciples of old school French chefs that came from fine dining, white tablecloth restaurants. And they all are young restaurant owners who are not French. You know, like, there was a couple restaurants I remember that stood in front of me. There was one where the female chef owner was actually half Filipino, half French, and worked under French Brigade her whole career. And now she has her own spot, no white tablecloths, and she's putting Filipino flavors in French food. Mm. Like in 2010, like that was unheard of. You know, I was enamored by that. There was Le Clown, which is a Japanese chef mm-hmm. who was putting Japanese flavors with French food. Again, this Neo-Parisian took me by a storm and I was in love with it. And I would tell myself, I hope that happens for Chinese food one day. And so when the time came for Yan to be born and Colin wanted me to describe the food, that was the only thing that came in my mind. Was Neo-Chinese, because that's all that is happening right now in our generation, is that we have spent our whole career cooking Western food, cooking food that is not ours, and now we're able to be given a platform to share it in our eyes through our interpretation. And I think the word Neo-Chinese is the best fitting. That word is also being used, I think, recently in the States for Neo-Cajun cuisine. So there is kind of a renaissance happening right now for all these different second, third, fourth generation cooks incorporating their heritage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What do you think is the biggest misconception about Chinese food or Asian food in general, we'll say, that you've kind of experienced in your career, possibly even now? What's the, and how do you address them?
I think it's just the lack, the people not understanding the diversity there is first in Chinese culture.
Because, it's not a monoculture.
Yeah, it's not like you cannot separate food and culture in Chinese culture. Like you can do that in North America, you can't do that in Asian cultures. You know, from how the food is consumed to how it's stored to how it nourishes your body, it is all connected in one. How do I explain this? For example, when I think about Chinese food, when I'm eating a dish, I think immediately about how it connects to us. You know, that's the first thing our parents think about. Like for instance, if I'm eating too much fried food, the first thing our parents think about is it's gonna make you sick. You're gonna have a sore throat. You know, these are things that are embedded in our culture. And in order for that to be more embedded into mainstream culture, people should be more informed about the stories behind it, why we came here, how did it become that. I think that that's definitely the most important thing that jumps out.
Yeah. Just kind of as we round out our discussion here, what message do you hope your food ultimately conveys to your diners about kind of the just Asian diaspora experience?
First and foremost, always just want people to have a good time when they come to Yan. Want people to have a good time. I want them to genuinely be open-minded about the food. And I want people to start expanding their box of what they conceive as Chinese cuisine. Like, I don't serve a single food that mimics what's happening right now in Chinese Canadian restaurants for that reason. You know, what's out there already exists. Mm-hmm. I'm not here trying to remake it or make it better. Neo Chinese is specifically trying to open the door for food that people have not seen before, but has been living in our society for so long, you know? As simple as serving a Chinese-inspired breadboard. That was my last month's menu. Is that how I... Breadboard is everywhere. There's a bread basket in every good restaurant you can think of. There's bread baskets in lobster, Red Lobster, you know? How is it that no one has ever thought about what would it be like if there's a Chinese breadboard? These are all Western practices. But how would we do that if we put that into Chinese culture? You go to restaurants in China, breadboard is not a culture.
Right.
If anything, there should be a rice tasting board, right?
True.
But what would happen? But there is a lot of breads in Chinese food.
Mm.
So why can't our people also accept that we could start a meal with a Chinese breadboard, with four different types of Chinese-inspired dips, you know? So I want to bring the best of Western culture also back into Chinese food. And that's what I want people to leave Yan pondering and thinking, you know, why can't we do this? Why can't we try that? That is all what I want to see become part of Canada's history and culture.
Yeah. And building on that, what would you say is the thing that excites you the most about the road ahead?
I think being able to see more talent grow in my community is what really gets me excited. I think that was something that we never got the representation when we were young. I still remember up to this day when I was a young cook, the only representation I had was Anita Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eating at her restaurant at that time was like mind blowing because, oh my God, there's Chinese vinegar in my foie gras pot sticker, you know? So, you know, I certainly hope that the future doesn't hold just one or two chefs now as representation. The future, I hope, will be a lot more. And I get inspired by that. So I am looking forward to being more inspired by the younger generation coming out and owning this culture better than we ever did. I hope the road ahead is much easier for them.
Yeah. What a great note to end the interview on. I love that.
Yeah, great question.
That's so great. Thank you so much for the chat.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?